Welcome back to the Group Answers Podcast, episode 55. I am Brian Daniels, always here with my co-host Chris Surratt. Chris, we're winding up February, rolling towards March, and I'm declaring winter officially over.
I think it is. In Nashville today, it's like 80 degrees. You know, but what I'm more excited about is March means March Madness. Huge college basketball fan, so I will be doing a pool or two, and we'll see how it goes. I never win, but I'm excited. I'm excited to watch the games, excited for spring. It's finally here.
Well, being from Kentucky, you know that's not something that I would keep up with.
I wouldn't think so. I mean, you don't have any good teams.
With us today, Chris, we're very excited. We're always excited, but we've got Jeff Vanderstelt, author today. Jeff, welcome to the Group Answers, or back to, I should say, the Group Answers podcast.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
So for those of you that don't know, Jeff is the visionary leader for Saturate, the Soma family of churches, but also a teaching pastor at Doxa Church in Bellevue, Washington. He travels around the world training and equipping the church in the gospel and the missional living, and the author of Saturate, Gospel Fluency, and the new small group study, Making Space. He and his wife, Jane, have three children. So, Jeff, I know you are all over the place. Are you actually in the Northwest today, or are you out somewhere else?
I am in the Northwest, yes, in Bellevue at the moment, and clearly, you guys have a different reality than I do, because you're saying it's spring, and when I drove in, it was 29 degrees and cloudy, so it doesn't feel like spring here yet.
Our apologies.
But that's Seattle. So.
I was going to say, is it never not cloudy and raining in Seattle?
Yeah, spring doesn't really start. I mean, we get spring, in April, May, but we don't really get great, sunny, nice weather until right after July 4th. That's usually what we're aiming for. So
I do have to say, I've been to Seattle a handful of times, and the rainfall is different there. See, here we have two settings. There's like storm and not storm. Those are the two settings we got. So to experience just something that you may call showers or rainfall was a completely different experience when I've been there.
Yeah, it's not really raining hard. I mean, most, usually know who the out-of-towners are because they're carrying an umbrella. We're just so used to it. It's usually a sprinkle or a mist. Once in a while you get a downpour, but usually it's kind of just misty.
So, Jeff, you're in and out of all kinds of discussions about groups, community, and especially group leadership. Just based on all of those interactions and, your own research and conclusions, what do you think is the most neglected topic in the group ministry conversation?
Well, I'd probably say, I'm going to say three, actually, if that's okay. One is gospel fluency. My observation is most groups are not trained in how to actually speak the gospel to one another. And I'm not talking about just, Jesus died on the cross for your sins so you can have a future hope after you die. I'm talking about actually being able to speak the gospel into everyday normal life. Most people give, worldly wisdom, maybe some Bible answers that oftentimes fall into moralism or legalism in groups. And so they don't really grow very effective in seeing how Christ applies to all things. That's my first. The second would be most groups don't seem to get, from my observation, that they're called to be disciples of Jesus who make disciples of Jesus. So they oftentimes have a very internal focus and lack the external focus. Or if they push hard towards the external, they lack the internal. They don't know how to build each other up and reach the lost at the same time. And then I think the last one would be most groups tend to not have a view on shared leadership, where there's a group of people sharing the leadership of the group versus just a person. And oftentimes groups are led in the same manner in which churches are led, and that is you have a kind of like a senior pastor model, and then every single ministry has a one person kind of directing the ministry, of which others are kind of submitting to. And that usually filters into small group ministry as well, which to me really stands in the face of the ministry of Jesus, where he had a team, he sent them out in pairs. Paul's worst ministry times when he was alone and didn't have a team. So I just think team ministry, shared ministry in groups is really important.
When you address that, particularly that last one of shared leadership, what kind of counsel do you give pastors and group leaders?
Well, for pastors, I encourage them, first of all, they have to model it. If they're not doing any kind of shared leadership of the church, then it's pretty hard to lead your people to follow something you're not willing to do yourself. So they're going to have to model it and probably shared preaching, sharing their platform, shared leadership and how they lead the everyday work of the church, how they lead staff and all that. And I'm not against the visionary leader. I'm a visionary leader of our church. Some would say, yeah, Jeff, you really like the senior pastor, but I do share platform. We share preaching. I'm submitting to other leaders in areas where they're much stronger than I am. So I think it's got to start with a pastor leading by example. And then I think group leaders, I mean, most groups, the reason why group leaders tend to burn out is because they're trying to carry everything. And so I really encourage them to look at the Ephesians 4 picture that, you know, you've got many who have been given to the church to equip the saints for the work of ministry. As each part is growing up, each part should be able to equip others. So try to identify who God's given you in a group and ensure that at least those who are growing in maturity all have a role in order to share the leadership of the group. So I encourage every group leader to take some time to identify who are the gifts God's given us and how might they all have a unique role in sharing and responsibility of this group. And that might look like moving the hosting from one home to the next. It might look like sharing administrative tasks of the group. Sometimes it's, hey, we got an evangelist and they're really going to help us reach the lost. Got someone else who really is the Bible girl or guy that loves to make sure we're in the Word. We've got these other shepherding types who love to care for one another. Like, let's give them all a role in somehow leading us in those ways as a group.
I agree with that, Jeff. I think that really gives ownership, and it hopefully moves the group members from consumers to owners. I mean, if you're just showing up at the group and not using your gifts, you're just going to consume. And the idea of group life is you're supposed to own it. And that's how you create disciples, is when you own the process. So that's really good. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit about discipleship environments. And I've heard you talk about this at conferences, and I love your view on it, but kind of the life on life, life in community, and life on mission. Have you seen these coexist well? And what are these churches have in common that kind of pull this off?
Well, the way I've seen it exist well is when you have an integrative approach to disciple making. And so you, like, for instance, to give you an example, here at Doxa, we call everyone who's going to be a member at Doxa commits to gather, go, give, grow. They gather together on Sundays to be equipped and encouraged to be disciples and make disciples. They go on mission in a missional community where they identify a group of people that they want to reach, and they really do it together in community. They give their time, talents, and resources towards those things, and then they're going to grow in smaller groups that we call DNA groups. When they work best is when a missional community, which could be anywhere between a dozen to 30 people, when the missional community is on mission together, living life in community outside of just once a week meeting. So when it's only once a week meeting, it's pretty hard to have life on life. But then when we break them down into their DNA groups, which is like three guys in that missional community or three ladies in that missional community who press in much more closely on the heart, applying the gospel to the heart, being in the Word together, developing each other. When you integrate those DNA groups in a missional community and then they gather together, ideally on Sunday at the same service time, then I've got this group of people who are learning to do life on life, life in community, life on mission, because they're with each other enough to know each other, press into each other. They don't try to make their small group a very, very intimate accountability group because they've got that in their DNA group, and they don't try to do tons of teaching in their missional community weekly meal or meeting time because that Sunday does that. And so when you begin to integrate those, and you then, even as leaders who lead Sunday, you start to think through, how do we use Sunday to equip them for every day? How do we make even sermon discussions lead not just to discuss the message, but to actually apply it in community on mission? So even our questions in our sermon discussion guides are, okay, if this were to be something you believed and you then were to obey, how would you obey it together in your community? And how would you work this out on the mission field where you're trying to reach people? So when you integrate all that together, and the whole church is expected to do that, and everything we do from Sunday to every day is affirming that, that's where I've seen it work the most effective. And I've seen it work itself out in adults. Our student ministries do the exact same thing at our church. So they're expected to to be in a missional community, to be in a DNA group, and to work from Sunday to every day, the stuff that we're teaching them. Our children's ministry does the same thing. They're working through the exact same content that we're teaching their parents on Sunday in the gathering. They're working it out in their own context. So when the whole church can be moving in the same direction and everybody in the body is expected to live this kind of life, that's where I've seen it most effectively work out.
That's so good.
And I should add one more thing.
Go ahead.
A key to this is that when a church sees their goal, their primary goal, as making disciples who make disciples, not just getting people to attend Sunday. Another way to think about this is that so many churches, if they were to draw out what is the center of their emphasis, most of them would say it's Sunday, and then groups exist to either support it or to assimilate into, or to build a retention strategy, or to supplement what Sunday can't do. I would do it the other way. I'd say at the center is disciples who make disciples in community on mission, and Sunday exists to support that, to equip toward that, but it is not the center of the target.
That's so good. And I'd love for you to talk a little bit. I heard you one time say that you're not a big fan of one-on-one discipleship, kind of that mentoring relationship. But when you talk about that life on life, it's more of the three or four that meet together. Why is that? Why are you not a fan of one-on-one?
Yeah, and clarify, certainly there's going to be times when you have a mentor or you do some one-on-ones, but I think if that's your primary means of discipleship, unfortunately you end up looking like the other person that's mentoring you. And we don't want people to look like one other person in the church. We want them to look like Jesus. And, you know, Paul is adamant, Ephesians 4, Romans 12, 1 Corinthians 11 and 12, he's adamant that we need all the parts of the body to build up the body into maturity. And unfortunately, too many, I think, leaders apply that to how do we pull off our ministry instead of how do we make disciples. Mm-hmm. And I think when we apply that to making disciples, we realize, man, I, as a man, need not just a man speaking into my life. I need women around me as well, because I'm a complementarian who believes we need men and women in ministry. I need to be shaped by both men and women. Now, yeah, I need to be developed by men in particular ways that only a man can develop me, but I need women to speak into my life. And I need a multiplicity of gifts to grow me up in ways I would never grow up if I didn't have those gifts around me. And so I need more than one person, because the tendency is when you do mentoring or one-on-one, you tend to gravitate to somebody like you or someone you want to be like. Mm. And unfortunately, what that leads you to is a very monolithic picture of what it means to be like Christ, instead of a very diverse picture of what Christ is really like.
That's so good. And if you look at the way Jesus did it, he had three or four that were close. It wasn't really one-on-one. He had one-on-one conversations, but it was three or four really doing life together. That's so good.
You won't find in the Gospels a picture of primarily a one-on-one discipleship. You just won't find it. You won't find it in Paul's writings. You won't find it in the story of the Acts account of the apostles. Like, you just won't find it. It's not normative. It's the exception.
Jeff, just one quick follow-up question on this. With Life on Life, I'm in one of those groups. My question when this comes up in other contexts is always, how do you resource those Life on Life groups? What do they do? In our group, I will come up with something and we walk through, we begin with the text, look at the underlying theology, and then move towards application. And we've talked a little bit about that on the show. Do you have any recommendations as to how that works best?
Yeah, the reason why we called our groups DNA groups is because we basically follow a pattern of DNA, discover. So discover the truths about who God is, what he's done, who we are, and what we do from the text. So we answer those four questions in our own personal study. And then in the group, we share those answers. Then nurture, where am I struggling to believe these truths? Where do I need to repent where I've not believed them? And what needs to happen in my heart? Where is the unbelief or the brokenness or the parts that might need to be redeemed? And so we go after the heart at that point. And then act is now, in light of what we've experienced together, what am I going to act on? What am I going to do differently, or who am I going to tell about what God just did in my life? So we usually ask, what am I going to do and who am I going to tell? And we've developed a whole guide on how to build a DNA group around that. It's actually a 16-week study that we can guide our groups through to establish that kind of thinking and process in regular ways in their lives. And then we write DNA guides as well, where people can work that out from the message we preached on Sunday. They can then work out DNA in their DNA groups based upon what we taught them on Sunday.
We just recently started a product called the Daily Discipleship Guide, which kind of does the same thing. It has kind of the group discussion questions, and then it has some questions that you can take deeper with your DNA group or your D group or whatever you kind of call that triad quad group. So I think some kind of guided conversation is key there. Let me ask you this, Jeff. In your opinion, what is the biggest challenge facing groups and group leadership today?
I would say that the biggest challenge that I've observed is that we have a radically individualistic and therefore isolated people. To get people to commit, to be together, to share life, to open up their life, when they live their life in such individualistic and isolated ways, and social media has not helped us on this at all. We do a thing called Missional Community Pilot Group, where we kind of start up new missional communities through an 8-week experiential study. And there was a woman probably in her 60s in the group. And at one point she came to me, it's like week 2 or 3. And she said, "Man, I'm scared to death. You're going to ask us to share our story in this group." And she said, "You know what? On social media, I am so popular. Everybody knows me. I'm so connected. But like here, I am like freaking out that anybody would actually know anything about me. I can't do this." And just to see that kind of like dualistic reality where people think they're connected, they think they're relating, they think they have friends, they think they know how to be in community, and then you put them in real community and they freak out because they've been so trained to create a facade through Instagram, through Snapchat, whatever it may be. I think that is one of the biggest challenges we have right now.
So here's the tee up question. Thanks, Jeff, for all of that. What question? So when you and I were together out, it was, I guess it's been back in the fall now, you know, we talked about your travel schedule and all the things you've got going on. So like I said at the top of the show, you're in and out of so many conversations. And I think you take on a posture of listening just as often as you take on a posture of teaching and sharing. So just based on that, I think our listeners would be interested in knowing what question you get asked the most as you make your rounds.
Well, because I emphasize disciple making in community, in everyday life, the question I get asked over and over and over again is, how do you get busy people to live this way? I mean, their lives are full. They have no room for anything else. How in the world do you get those kinds of people to have life on life, life in community, and life on mission approaches to discipleship? That's the number one I get all the time.
Fair enough. So then the natural follow-up is, what are those things that tend to, you know, stand in the way? Or is, Chris, I don't think I want to quote Shakespeare. I almost went there when Friar Lawrence,
You should.
Friar Lawrence said, what thwarts our best intent? Gosh, I hate it when I do that. what keeps us from making space for those things that do matter most?
I'm convinced it's our affections. We do what we love. We spend our time on what we think grants us significance, gives us security, sets up our image or our sense of significance, identity. And so at the heart of it is you have competing affections you're dealing with. And so people love to have things, so they're going to, at least where I'm at, they're workaholics to get more stuff. They love to have an identity that's significant, so they want to get the promotion. They've bought into the lie, which I think they just are not paying attention how much they give into the flesh, the world and the devil, in terms of like feeding this ego that's outside of Christ, that finds its sense of significance somewhere other than in the person and work of Jesus Christ. They bought into the lie of the world that you still don't have enough and you still are not enough. And of course, the evil one is just constantly stirring up all the wrong affections towards all the wrong things. And so people are seeking to meet their longings in ways that only Jesus could ultimately fulfill. And so when I'm with people, this just happened to me this last week as going through the Mission Community Pilot Group, and I was talking about making space to rest. So yeah, work hard, but then rest. I mean, take some time off, take a regular day off, get on a vacation with your family, go with your missional community away. And man, I'm looking around the room and people are like staring at me like, are you kidding me? How in the world could we do that? And I started to kind of walk around the room and say, what's going on? What are you guys thinking? And then I had these two couples just go, you just like tapped on the central nerve. Like, this is the fundamental issue in our walk with God, in our marriage, in our family. You're calling us to something we don't know how to do because we don't know how to say no to work. We don't know how to say no to this busy life that we've just adopted, and we don't know how to get out of it. And so I just started to counsel them on, okay, why do you do what you do? And the guy's like, man, I have to work this many hours because I'm like, why? And he's like, because if I don't, I mean, I won't get the promotion. I go, you are buying into a lie. I mean, God has raised up leaders throughout the years in the most crazy places. I mean, whether it's Joseph or Moses or, you know, Jesus's disciples, I mean, you just look at how they got positioned when they didn't deserve it. And you're just buying into the world system for how to step up the ladder instead of trusting in a God who could, if you would obey him and submit to him and trust him and even engage in the fact that he wants you to rest, because he'll still be working while you're resting, you're going to find he's going to be able to do way more than what you can do. And so just, I'm counseling people on that all the time. And it's always a matter of misdirected affections and going to a means that they think will give them what they most long for, but it's almost always contrary to the very nature and purposes of God in our lives.
So, Chris, Jeff, we kicked off our group last week with the question, what is true rest, with the emphasis on true? And it's a part of the study that we're doing. We haven't started making space yet. I've got that in the queue. But some of the answers, one of the things that I think has emerged out of our contemporary culture is this, Jeff, just like what you said, there's the lie. There's lots of lies and always have been. I think sometimes our constant barrage of information only reiterates a lot of that coming from the world around us. But, you know, one of my you guys tell me what you think about this. One of the things that I hear from time to time are references to the man cave. One, isolation like that is the last thing a man needs. But two, when I hear that, I think of, so you think that watching football, which, you know, a lot of times that's what that means. Not necessarily obviously not all the time, but a lot of time it's watching some sports event or movies or something by myself all day long, and that's the way that I will find rest. And that's just wrong. That true rest is not found in any of those things that you would typically or may typically associate with, you know, recovery and rest. And it's more of the things, Jeff, frankly, that you identify in making space. I want to get, so in terms of group life, it's interesting that you would get that question as you engage people in these disciple-making environments of life on life, life on community, and life on mission. That the idea of rest is something that maybe culturally we've just lost. We've lost it. That Scripture is actually rest, and meditation on the law and prayer, those kinds of things that actually ask, nay, demand something from us, is actually restful. And that's something that we've just gotten wrong over the years, and that's where we find ourselves. So, Jeff, when you decided to apply the principles of making space to your life, and these principles are basically finding, you know, making space as the title for what matters most, and the topics of this study, you know, just for those of you that are not aware, are things like money, work, rest that we just talked about, time in the Word and prayer, heart, friendship, parenting, family, hospitality even. Jeff, where did you begin that process? What was your first step?
Well, I mean, I don't have time to tell you my whole story, but I think part of it was just looking back and what gave me the most life in childhood and where I saw my family experience life and where I saw them not experience life, where abundant life was not a real kind of realized. So I think, you know, I could tell my story and go, man, there's just so many places. I started to go, wait a minute, I see patterns here of brokenness. I see patterns here of life-giving opportunities. And so I think that would be, you know, just the narrative of my life and looking at when was life abundant? When was life life-giving? But I think especially spending time in the Proverbs for me, just I had set aside time every – I do like a lot of people do. I read the Bible every day, spend time in prayer every day, try to listen to God speak to me through his word. And I had made it a goal that I would just read one proverb every day. You can get through the book of Proverbs in a month over and over again. And I did that for several years, just continuing to be in the Proverbs. And so you just see this picture of the wise life, the life that the life of wisdom is a life that is abundant. It's life giving. And then looking at the life of Christ and how did he live this out himself? Because he is for us the picture of the perfect human. He is the perfect human, but he also is a display of wisdom embodied. And so how did he live? Clearly he accomplished a lot. We're not talking about a guy who's not busy. We're not talking about a guy who doesn't have tons of demands on his life. And yet he did it in a way that was perfect. It was absolutely in line with the intent of God for how he created humanity. So I think those two things. And then as I began to do that, I realized, you know, there's some key principles that you'll find in the life of Christ and in the Proverbs. I know for me, one of the key ones, because I'd already established a rhythm of reading the word, being in prayer on a daily basis. My wife and I, years ago, had established, I take a day off every week. We're going to be intentional about rest. But I began to implement silence and solitude into that, where I would once a month take an entire day and just be quiet, shut everything off. I don't get to bring my phone. I don't get to bring a computer. I just bring my Bible and my journal and I'm just quiet with the Lord for a whole day to listen, to let him speak to me, to maybe even not have him speak, to let the silence be okay. And ask myself, am I okay in silence? Or is the murmur of my heart crying out so loud that I don't even know how to be quiet? I don't even know how to listen. And usually paying attention to the murmur of your heart tells you what you're most consumed with, what you're most anxious with, what is probably consuming your energies and time. And so I just began to do that once a month. I've even now implemented that for our church, where our leaders are all, we call them all to take at least once a quarter, a day of solitude. We try to pick the same day so we can then talk about what we heard and what we learned from God in those times. So, and then in those days of solitude, I just invite the Spirit of God to tell me how my life needs to be rearranged. Like what is not in line with wisdom? What is not in line with the life of Christ? What kind of life am I living that God is saying to me, this is not healthy. This is not life-giving. So just letting him reorder my life on a regular basis so I can continue to invite him to say, here's how you make space, Jeff, for what matters most in your life. That has been the biggest deal for me, is letting him then rearrange the order of my week, the order of my month, the order of my year.
So how do you take those principles that you're talking about and are espoused in making space? And how do you take those and contribute to effective group leadership? How can they use these as a group leader to help their group?
Well, I think one of the things that we try to do in making space is identify what are those things that we just see. These are life-giving. These are God-ordained realities that a flourishing human will engage in. So I think even just to start with at a group level, say like, do we even know what those things are? And do we know why they give life? And would we know how to engage in them and even rearrange our life for them? I think the beauty of doing the Making Space study in a group is that you get to then reflect on it with each other. And even it creates an accountability where you can say, man, here's the area I don't do well in, or here's the types of things I've never really made space for in my life. We can help each other. Some will say, man, I'm really good at that. That's been an area I've been really strong in, but I'm weak in this area. How about if I speak into and help you grow in that area while you speak into this area of my life. So I think doing it in a group, identifying what are those key areas of life that we need to make space for, key activities that are life-giving. And I think by doing it together, we can both discover what the Proverbs say about living in a way that's wise. What does Jesus do that shows us how to do it and enables us to do it? And I think doing it in a group allows us then to be honest with each other. Hey, here's where I need help. Here's where I need you to hold me accountable or encourage me. And I'm always for spiritual growth happening in community. And I think the kinds of topics you're going to talk about in making space are the types of things a group should be talking about anyway. I mean, if a group is not working through these kinds of things together, they're likely not very healthy on an individual level. And because of that, probably as a group, they're not going to experience the kind of group life they could have.
Well, making space will be the next study that my group does, for sure. We have a bunch of 20-somethings that need this message, and myself. I need this message. It's good stuff.
And that's going to wrap it up for episode 55. And Chris, for the first time, we have co-sponsors, smallgroup.com and Saturate. And for those of you that don't know, Saturate, you can learn more at saturatetheworld.com. As an organization, is committed to seeing a gospel saturation movement happen in North America and beyond. Jeff and the Saturate team want to partner with God, like-minded churches and individuals as he brings about the vision of seeing every man, woman, and child have a daily encounter with Jesus in word and deed. Jeff, is that sufficient?
That's great.
Nothing more, nothing less. And Lifeway, our team, has partnered with Saturate for making space that is available now at Lifeway.com and at Lifeway stores and I would assume other places. And just a little bit about that study, making space will help you and your group, just like Chris said, identify what matters most to God and to you as a believer of Christ, and will help you incorporate those activities into your busy life. And you know, you just call it commitment creep almost. It's just more and more and layers and layers. Each of these 8 weeks, your group will examine a topic that's important but often neglected or wrongly engaged, gleaning wisdom from the book of Proverbs, which is important, and the example of Jesus, also important, we would all agree. Making space will help you avoid empty, unfulfilling business and devote your time to the pursuits that matter most in life. It's a great Bible study resource, and Jeff, we're just happy to be in partnership with all of you guys. If you want to follow,
I'm very thankful as well. Thanks, guys.
If you want to follow Jeff on Twitter, that's at Jeff Vanderstelt, common spelling. Also, right. You know, it's a little joke we do. Or at jeffvanderstelt.com. Anything else, guys?
Not everybody can have two first names. Daniel.
Well, yeah, and one of these days we'll get into the third middle, the third name that's a part of, the third first name that's a part of that. All right, Jeff, appreciate your time today. How about we do it again one of these days?
I look forward to it. Thanks, guys.
And I still have to tell you, next time we're together, it may be 5 years, but I've got to tell you a story that you will appreciate. So anyway, look forward to being with everyone again in episode 56. Once again, that's Chris Surratt. Thank you, Chris, for being our producer, engineer, editor, and co-host. And again, Jeff, for your time. You're very gracious.